Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
As COVID-19 cases continue to rise, the U.S. government is quietly offering benefits to some businesses.
Ordinarily, companies have to file a report whenever they release pollution above a certain threshold. And this rule basically says that they no longer have to do that. It allows them to pollute and not get caught.
I'm Matt Katz. This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 1st. Also, how African American and African immigrant communities are handling the 2020 census. Then, what the Justice Department's narco-terrorism charges against Venezuelan President Maduro mean. And then the latest in our series with comedians talking about how they're handling social distancing.
I think I'm half falling in love with the person I can see outside my window at all times, but how he's very devastatingly, he like shut his curtains a couple weeks ago, so now I really miss him.
Let's get into it. The global pandemic of COVID-19 has plunged the world into a crisis, not just a health crisis, but an economic one as well. As governments around the world scramble to attempt to keep the economy from slipping any further, the death toll continues to rise. More than 43,000 people worldwide have been confirmed dead as a result of COVID-19. While all this is happening, the U.S. government is quietly offering benefits to some businesses. Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced that it's relaxing environmental regulations for companies, including factories and power plants. The new rule says businesses can decide for themselves if they can meet requirements for reporting air, water, and other types of pollution. The policy is meant to address requests from businesses that have asked for more relaxed regulations, citing the coronavirus pandemic. So for an undetermined period of time, the EPA will not issue fines for violating water, air, and other pollution reporting requirements. This isn't the first time we've seen governments use a crisis to enact unpopular or controversial policies, but that doesn't mean some positive policy changes can't be born from this too. Naomi Klein and Kendra Pierre Lewis know a lot about this. Naomi is the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University, and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And Kendra is a climate reporter for the New York Times. I asked Kendra to explain first off what exactly the EPA's move allows.
Basically, it allows them to pollute and not get caught. Ordinarily, companies have to file a report basically whenever they release pollution above a certain threshold under the Clean Water and the Clean Air Acts. And this rule basically says that they no longer have to do that, that they're not going to be looking. And the EPA says it's because of COVID-19 that these facilities, they're taxed, they don't have as many resources, and that, you know, also the EPA doesn't have as many resources, and so it's just sort of an emergency measure. But it comes about a week after the American Petroleum Institute sort of asked for these kinds of regulations to be taken back. And it also comes as the EPA has reached a 10-year low in inspections. So we're already not really tracking inspections the way we did over the past decade. And in fact, since 2016, air pollution nationwide has gone up.
Wow. So regarding air pollution, how is it relevant to the COVID-19 outbreak in terms of air pollution and its relationship to respiratory illnesses that we know are so tied to this outbreak?
You know, no one's directly studied, like, what does it mean to have COVID-19 in a very polluted atmosphere because it's a novel virus. But we know in general that respiratory infections go up. When air pollution goes up, it makes you more susceptible having air pollution to respiratory infections. And in fact, on the other side, the Forest Service has decided not to do prescribed burns this spring because of the adverse effects to at-risk populations. So on the one hand, there's a government agency essentially saying air pollution is a problem with COVID-19. We're going to make sure not to create more of it. And then there's another side that's saying we're not checking.
Naomi, why do you think the EPA and also other government agencies are choosing a time like this to relax these sorts of regulations, especially given the negative public health consequences?
Well, unfortunately, we see many of these same ideas emerge in the aftermath of all kinds of different and seemingly unrelated crises. When I wrote The Shock Doctrine in 2007, I began with a quote from Milton Friedman, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." And I think what Kendra was saying about the fact that the Trump administration has really waged an unrelenting war on the EPA since it took office. Some of the very first executive orders that Donald Trump introduced were taking aim at environmental standards. Then it goes back even further. I reported in the Shock Doctrine on a meeting that happened after Hurricane Katrina. The city was still partially underwater. It took place in Washington. And out of that meeting came 32 what they called pro-market solutions to Hurricane Katrina and, at the time, high oil prices. Now we have very low oil prices. But what's striking is the so-called solutions are many of the policies that we're seeing now: relaxing enforcement of environmental standards, rolling back taxes and all kinds of regulations. And one of the things that's pretty relevant about that is that the chair of that meeting was a guy named Mike Pence, who is in charge of Trump's COVID-19 response. So this is a pattern, and it's really about exploiting the fact that during times of crisis, regular people are focused on the daily emergency of life, and they aren't able to put as much scrutiny on their elected representatives as they otherwise would. And so this is recognized as an opportunity to sort of tick off the wish list, if you will. It's all the things that the oil and gas industry wants. And it's also the coal industry has been pushing to suspend their required payments into funds for former workers with black lungs.
Just, I feel like one of the things that gets lost in that conversation is that black lung is essentially COVID-19 jams on lung damage. And so black lung, if you have it, if you have the lung damage that you would associate with coal mining, you are an at-risk person. You're much more likely to get a really kind of catastrophic variant of it.
So right. Not only is it not an actual solution to the crisis we're in, it actually exacerbates the conditions that make this crisis so much worse.
And are there any other communities, groups of people that are likely to suffer from these relaxed standards, particularly the relaxed pollution regulations?
Basically anywhere that's relatively low income or communities of color, because that's where these facilities are disproportionately sited, right? Like, these are not in generally affluent, predominantly white communities. They put them in predominantly low income communities, and they put them in communities of color. And so these are the people who are most likely to suffer when these facilities emit more pollution.
Kendra, from the company's perspective, I mean, EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler said that the COVID-19 pandemic might impact the ability of some companies to meet the regulations. Is there any validity in that and any justification in that in terms of relaxing these regulations?
We are all people. Many places are working short staff for kind of valid reasons, but it's just a question of what you're deeming essential or not essential, right? The government is saying that pollution controls are not essential.
Right.
The other thing I think that's worth mentioning is that this is unfortunately a global trend that we're seeing. China's economy took a big hit, and now they are looking to revive their economy to get back to growth. And one of the ways that the Chinese government is doing this, they've announced, is by suspending enforcement of environmental standards.
Kendra, the EPA isn't the only administration to relax regulations like this. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has also decided to relax regulations, and they're suspending some routine food inspections. What does that mean?
It's a little bit less clear, actually, than with the EPA. Our food and drug system is kind of a patchwork. There are many entities sort of regulating it. And oftentimes, for example, like a large supermarket chain might employ its own individual inspectors. But what it does mean is we know grocery stores are really taxed. We know workers are really taxed. And so each of these layers to our food system are already kind of stretched to their max, and we're removing one added layer. One of the things that really struck me when I was thinking about these topics is testing, right? Because if we don't test, we can't know, we can't trace back. And if we can't trace back, we can't isolate, right? Like, so that's partly why we're all sort of stuck inside right now. And it's kind of the same thing with food systems. When you have these outbreaks, you need to be able to go back and you need to sort of figure out where they're coming from, and you need to be able to trace. And lots of those systems have sort of been eroded over the past few years, partially because of immigration crackdown, and we don't talk enough about how important immigration is to our food system. So lots of workers are still working, but if they get sick, they are maybe not going to turn up at a hospital because they don't want to get turned over to immigration. So there are all of these kind of like layers to our food system that have sort of been eroded over the past 3 years, and this is just another layer that's been eroded.
The flip side of the sort of corporate opportunism that we see during these moments of crisis is that crises are moments of revelation, you know, where we see our reality more clearly. And I think one of the things that a lot of people are realizing is that you can't have a safe food system if workers are not protected. And we're also seeing workers stand up for themselves, including very precarious workers at Amazon, at Whole Foods. It's a moment where we're seeing a push and pull from very powerful forces, and forces that didn't see their own power, didn't feel their own power before this crisis.
Naomi, do you envision other agencies following suit here?
You know, one of the first things we heard from Trump was rolling back or suspending payroll tax as a kind of a bailout. And the problem with that is that's how we fund Social Security. So what I would worry about is how down the road, a lot of these bailout measures turn into austerity, turn into, sorry, we can't pay for Social Security anymore. We can't pay for Medicaid anymore. We can't pay for your local school system anymore because we haven't transferred enough to the states and municipalities. So this isn't just about what is happening now. It's also about how what we're doing now is going to translate into cuts later on. That's a lesson from previous crises, including the 2008 financial crisis. The DOJ made moves to be able to have indefinite detention. And we are seeing in other countries like Israel and Hungary, also Brazil, very aggressive moves by political leaders to suspend democracy. The Washington Post said that Netanyahu had staged what they called a palace coup. Viktor Orban in Hungary has just announced that, or just won himself the right to rule by decree indefinitely. This is a global phenomenon, and we are seeing some really, really worrying attacks on basic democratic rights under cover of crisis and emergency.
But on the flip side, Naomi, you mentioned workers now asserting their rights at Amazon and elsewhere right now. And historically, times of crisis create change, sometimes in the way we're seeing with the EPA, but sometimes in a more progressive direction. What are some of the historical examples of when times of crisis actually produced positive policy change?
I think that the two biggest, most relevant periods in modern history are the New Deal. After the market crash of 1929, there were various sort of tinkering attempts to deal with the crisis. And then FDR was elected running on a New Deal platform. And it is for this reason that the United States has the social safety net that it has, whether unemployment insurance or Social Security, which are proving so important in this moment of crisis. And it also, you know, led to the electrification of rural America, the Civilian Conservation Corps, hundreds of state parks and so on, as an economic stimulus. The second period that I think we should think about is the Second World War and the aftermath of the Second World War, and how in many countries it was the returning soldiers and the sacrifice that every single family had made in the war effort that was the moral argument for universal public health care. That was certainly the argument to create the NHS in the UK. But also the Spanish flu won a robust social safety net in parts of Scandinavia.
Naomi Klein is the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University. And Kendra Pierre-Lewis is a climate reporter for The New York Times. Thanks so much to you both for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A On this show, we've been closely following the way various groups are working to avoid being undercounted in the census. And today, we're looking at the challenges for African-American and Black African immigrant groups. Now, those are two very different groups, but in the last census, they were counted under the same racial category. The 2020 census has changed that, allowing African immigrant groups to choose from five options: Nigerians, Jamaicans, Haitians, Ethiopians, and Trinidadians and Tobagonians. Before the COVID-19 pandemic took hold of the U.S., the takeaway is Duarte Geraldino spoke with two people directly working with those groups to make sure they're counted in the census.
My name is Jerry Green, and I am the 2020 Census Senior Advisor for the National Urban League.
My name is Abdurrahman Mahmoud. I'm the founder and the director of Tuinist, an online platform that connects immigrant job seekers to employers here in Minnesota, and I'm an immigrant advocate.
Duarte asked Jerry why the African-American community has been historically underrepresented.
The National Urban League has been looking at this issue since at least the last 50 years and noticing that we have been undercounted. In fact, in the 1970 census, the Census Bureau said that we were hard to count because we were coming out of the 1960s with the civil rights movement and things like that.
So, Jerry, when the objective is to make sure that Black people in the U.S. are counted, what challenges do census workers and community groups face?
Basically, there's fear and distrust in our community. That's essentially it. The African-American community does not believe that the government has its best interests at heart and therefore is reluctant to provide information to it. Many in our community don't understand or appreciate the power of the count. And it seems, of course, that on the other side, the power of the Black count has always been evident, which is why it has been suppressed for so many years over the course of, you know, decades and decades. But not understanding the power of the count, that the Black count can change political circumstances, that is political power and representation, and then not understanding how much resources, and these are not free resources, these are resources that we've paid for with our own taxes, program funding, almost $1 trillion in federal funding is reallocated to communities across the country based on the census count. So whether it's for SNAP and WIC, Pell Grants, funding for school lunch programs, Head Start, transportation, roads, and those things, there's just not enough information or awareness about the importance of those numbers.
Abdurrahman, you work with Black immigrants in Minneapolis to make sure that the census counts them. What do you think are the major challenges for African immigrants there?
When working with the Black immigrant communities here in Minneapolis and a lot of leaders that were doing, what we figure out is that immigrants, they have some sort of like immigrant background or refugee background, and they usually don't trust authority. And people are kind of like fearful when a stranger knocks their doors and ask them questions, and they don't know how to approach and what to answer. And they always kind of like try to not fully disclose their information.
How do you and the community organizers who are trying to make sure that this group of people living in the U.S. are counted do it, given that challenge?
Educating the people about the census process is number one. And also educating people about how the census information that's collected will impact their lives in the coming decade. And when we sit down with elders and community leaders and we educate them, they usually understand the importance and how this will impact their life. But the other challenge that we have is that the resource to do the job. We are a group of volunteers that's really dedicated to do this job, but we don't have the resources needed to do the job. We don't have enough volunteers. I wish we could have a lot of volunteers that are bilinguals that can help people with the forms.
I'd like to also kind of echo the fact that the folks in our community don't want to share information because they fear it's going to be shared with local law enforcement officials. Because of the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration, we have a disproportionate number of people, Black and brown, who are going into the prison system, and about 700,000 return home each year across the country. And so, of course, right there, we have an instant population that is already distrustful of providing information to the government.
So 700,000 people who were previously incarcerated get released every year. And you're seeing that among that group of 700,000 men and women, a large portion are reluctant to be counted on the census.
Absolutely. There's just a distrust that the Census Bureau is going to share that information with law enforcement, parole officers, or whatever.
What about the categories themselves, Jerry? We understand that there are some major changes in the way that Black people living in the U.S. are categorized by the U.S. Census.
There is a change. In the 2010 census, full disclosure, I was a Census Bureau employee a few years ago and was there in 2010 when the race question, we got calls from everywhere because in the race question for Black, your choices were, are you Black, African am, which I'm still trying to figure out what an African am is, or are you a Negro?
So what's a Negro versus...
Right. And that's what we got calls about. Young people from everywhere called the Census Bureau. And so after the Census Bureau did a lot of work, a great deal of work, research over the decade, we often heard from members of our African diaspora that they didn't see themselves in this race question, Black, African, am, Negro. And so the Census Bureau has now added, after much advocacy on behalf of Caribbean and African populations, they've added examples into the Black question. So what you have now are examples where you can see in the Black question, Nigerian, Jamaican, Ethiopian, Haitian, and other populations so that the broader Black immigrant population can see itself. And if you don't like those examples, you can write in your own.
Do you think, given these changes, that the recorded portion of Black people in the U.S. will increase?
It's about education. So we're holding hands and bringing the National Urban League is indeed working with organizations that represent Black immigrants like BAJI, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, and things like that to make sure we get the word out. We're hoping that it will increase the Black count. But we are concerned about disinformation campaigns that are surfacing already to diminish the Black count.
Abdullah, how do you feel that these new categories of Blackness in America might affect the large refugee population in Minnesota?
In Minnesota, we have the largest Somali diaspora or Somali American community in the whole United States. And what happens is, if you are a Somali immigrant and you were born in Africa, they will consider you as African born. But your children who were born in Minneapolis or in Minnesota, they will be considered as African Americans. You see authorities in here in Minnesota, they always say Somali population in Minnesota, they are only 45,000. When in reality, when you talk to the people, they tell you like, hey, we are more than 150. Because all the Somali kids that are born in Minnesota or in the United States, they are not categorized as Somalis. They are categorized as African Americans. So now what we have in here is an opportunity for all African immigrants to categorize themselves the way they want.
Jerry, what are some of the big issues when it comes to the 2020 census that we just didn't see in 2010?
First of all, the census will be the first online census for the entire population. There were some experiments in the past. So issues of cybersecurity are very important this time. And we also have concerns about hacking. We're already seeing some disinformation, the weaponization of social media. We're concerned about that. Of course, that wasn't an issue in the previous census. We already have a situation where the Republican Party is using the census to misrepresent basically the census questionnaire. Republican Party has kind of co-opted the census questionnaire and have sent it out to thousands of people across the country as a fundraising mechanism. We've had complaints about that. And of course, there was the citizenship question that was out there that it will not be on the census form. We're really concerned about the fear that still exists in immigrant communities that there's a citizenship question on the form that's going to ask if they are, you know, citizens or not citizens. So we think there's going to be some spillover fear about that as well.
Abdurrahman, what do you say now to people in your community to get them to open the door and be counted? What's that pitch that you make to them?
The main pitch that we made to people is that the census is one is a decade, an opportunity that the community to to claim their position within the state, within the economy, within the politics, within everything, all the decisions that will be made. So we pitched them, if we don't participate 100% or not fully counted at this time, then we're losing a lot, because within the African diaspora community, there are a lot of them are really business minded. A lot of them are homeowners. A lot of them are doing good in education, in business, and entrepreneurial thing. And when it comes to the reputation or the community reputation, we can improve through the census.
Abdurrahman Mahmoud is an immigrant advocate in Minneapolis, and Jerry Green is the 2020 Census Senior Advisor for the National Urban League. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find all of our 2020 Census coverage at thetakeaway.org/2020census.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, who's on maternity leave. With the world focused on the global pandemic, the U.S. is continuing to pressure the government of Venezuela. Last week, the Justice Department unsealed charges against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and other top officials, alleging Maduro has been engaged in narco-terrorism. According to the indictment, Maduro helped lead the Cartel of the Suns, collaborating with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, also known as the FARC, to traffic cocaine into the U.S. And then on Tuesday, the State Department released a proposal for a leadership transition in the country. The plan would be for a 5-member council to rule over the country while elections are organized for later this year. Neither Maduro nor the U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido would preside during this time. These are only the latest of the U.S. attempts to remove Maduro from power. But with the globe facing an economic and health crisis, analysts are left wondering why the U.S. government chose this moment to unseal the charges, and if they'll prevent Maduro's government from agreeing to any negotiated transition of power. I asked Alejandro Velasco, associate professor of Latin American history at New York University, to explain the newly unsealed charges.
So they're alleging a criminal conspiracy that goes back nominally to 2006, which is when Maduro became foreign minister under Chavez, but really going back all the way to 1999 when Hugo Chavez was first elected, saying that the Chavez government and Maduro, first as minister and later as president following upon Chavez's death, were plotting to flood, this is the literal words from the indictment, flood the United States with cocaine, processed through Colombia and then sent through intermediary ports to the United States. Further alleges that, especially since 2015, that this operation has become basically one of the primary ways through which the Maduro government has been trying to destabilize the opposition and seek funds in order to enact its repression. And it links it to the ways in which the United States has also labeled the FARC in Colombia a terrorist organization. And so the narco trafficking charges are not new. The terrorism charges against the FARC are not new. The question is, why now? Why is this indictment being unsealed now?
And what's the point of the indictment? I mean, he's not going to be arrested and brought back to New York, right? I mean, what is the justification for this?
So here's where you get into a little bit of conjecture. I mean, there are several ways to think about the timing. The first one is that actually in light of the coronavirus crisis and the extent to which the Venezuelan public health system has been decimated over the last several years, there have been some really surprising and hopeful signs of rapprochement between sides of the opposition and sides of the government that had not really been seen for years. This was seen as a sign that perhaps these two sides could put aside some of their differences, the major differences that they have, and work collaboratively to tackle this crisis. And as has happened in other previous moments when there have been these attempts at rapprochement, the United States has sort of jumped in to basically put those efforts down by making it much harder, especially for the government, for the Maduro Chavista side to be able to partake in any kind of negotiations. That's one way to think about it. Another way is that this is really purely a political move by the Trump administration to secure the Florida vote, which is very much, is shaped by a sort of Cold War era politics of, hardline opposition, not only to the Cuban regime, but of course, increasingly to the Venezuelan government, as many Venezuelan expats live in Florida. So there's that, reading as well. The final reading is that perhaps this is a way to set the ground or to set the stage for an eventual, although this is far more of a far-fetched scenario, but who knows, set the groundwork for an eventual Panama 1989-like scenario where by having already labeled Maduro a narco-terrorist, they can invade and take him out that way. So any one of those possibilities is on the table.
Jeff, tell us about the trafficking organizations that the Department of Justice is claiming that Maduro is leading. What do they do?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting here is that, as Alejandro was saying, the allegations of involvement in drug trafficking or links to the FARC, these are not new. But what is new is the Justice Department holding up this shadowy network of corrupt figures in the armed forces, the Cartel of the Suns. And it's interesting because that name, the Cartel of the Suns, it was first penned by a journalist in the 1990s, referring to corruption within the armed forces in the years predating Chavez's rise to power. So, I mean, this is really just shorthand for corruption within the armed forces in Venezuela. As others have pointed out, the Cartel of the Suns, first of all, are not a cartel. Venezuela is not a drug-producing country. It is a transit country. And there's not much of a sense of a hierarchy among these sort of corrupt cells within the military. So we see this clear attempt to frame Venezuela as some kind of narco-state, as this series of linkages of power that simply don't respond to any kind of political logic, but to a criminal one.
You mentioned that Venezuela is not a drug producing state. It has a role in the trafficking. And you recently released a report on the trafficking flow. What do the drug trafficking patterns here look like from Venezuela or elsewhere to the U.S.?
So there's no question that there are significant organized crime groups operating in Venezuela, including drug trafficking organizations and Colombian guerrilla groups like the FARC. Very credible evidence of co-optation of state institutions in the country. But I think what's missing is a sense of scale here. As Alejandro mentioned, the announcement of the indictment claims that Maduro sought to flood the United States with cocaine in order to undermine the health and well-being of our nation. And if you just hear that, I mean, your first thought is, oh, gosh, I mean, Venezuela must be this superhighway for massive quantities of cocaine to the United States. And the reality is that's just not true. We just published a report looking at data from the U.S. Southern Command, the Interagency Consolidated Counterdrug Database, which is what the U.S. government actually uses to assess cocaine flow throughout the hemisphere. And what we found is that Venezuela is not a primary transit country for U.S.-bound cocaine. In 2018, for instance, about 200 metric tons of cocaine passed through Venezuela. That same year, about 10 times as much cocaine passed through Colombia, and 7 times as much cocaine passed through Guatemala. So, I mean, I think we have to ask ourselves, why is the administration ringing the alarm bells about the quantities of cocaine that are flowing through Venezuela, when at the same time, the same administration has worked to kill anti-corruption efforts in more significant transit countries like Guatemala and Honduras?
want to get a final thought from each of you on one thing that was touched on. The president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, has deep ties to organized crime. His brother was recently found guilty of drug trafficking in a U.S. federal court. Why unseal charges against Maduro but remain silent on Hernandez? Why do you think we're seeing this disparity from the U.S. government? Alejandro?
I mean, listen, I'm an historian of 20th century Latin America. I mean, that places me in a position where double standards vis-a-vis U.S. policy towards the region are not exceptional, but really par for the course. The reasons why are also having to do with not just the ways in which the United States sort of plays favorites around the region in terms of who it lends support to and who it opposes, but also in particular the Trump administration. I think what it has really shown here, as in other cases, is that even the facade of any kind of similar, you know, principled policy is really lost. And so why support Honduras and Hernandez? In part, it's because Hernandez and other Central American governments have supported the Trump administration in terms of its deportation policies. Why support Colombia? Well, because Colombia supports the Trump administration's policies around not just drug interdiction, but also energy policies and other kinds of efforts that are important to the Trump administration. So, you know, I think that often what we tend to talk about is that foreign policy is about interests, not about principles. And I think what we are seeing here is that those interests are primarily driven by domestic political interests in part of the Trump administration, not really about the welfare of Venezuela or Venezuelans. And that, of course, is the deeper tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think what this shows is this is less about policy than it is about politics. You know, many of the same people that are in the administration working on Venezuela policy, people like Special Envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, even Attorney General William Barr, I mean, these people played key roles in the pressure campaign that led up to the 1989 invasion of Panama. And so these people are operating from the same failed Cold War playbook. You know, in their minds, you know, more pressure is better. You know, we're in a moment where the Trump administration is being criticized left and right for its response to a global pandemic. And, you know, I think in part the administration is trying to shore up its support in Florida. So, you know, I don't think we can deny the politics here. I'm very critical of this decision. And I think it's worth mentioning that we're not alone in being critical of this. The reality is the reason that it took so long for these indictments to be unsealed, many of which have been in place for years, is that there was so much internal resistance to this move from the Department of State, from the people that have been working for a transition in Venezuela for years now.
Alejandro Velasco is an associate professor of Latin American history at New York University, and Jeff Ramsey is the director for Venezuela at the Washington Office on Latin America. Alejandro, Jeff, thanks for offering this context and this historical perspective. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Over the past week, for our series Joking from a Distance, we've been checking in with comedians to get a sense of how their work is changing while so many of us are staying at home. Today, we're checking back in with a guest we had on the show back in December for our series Laughing in Color.
Hi, my name is Karen Chi, and I'm a comedian and writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Obviously, a lot has changed in the months since Karen was on the show. This week, Late Night with Seth Meyers started broadcasting remotely after some time off the air. And Karen also got a chance to work on her own material during a comedy show held on Zoom. I sat down to chat with her about all of this. Karen, so nice to be talking to you again right now.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me.
So you performed on Zoom the other night as part of a comedy show that's normally held at a club in Brooklyn. What was that like?
It was actually really fun. The show was called Butter Boy, and it's normally held weekly on Monday nights. And this was exciting because it was a lineup of comedians, most of whom I already knew pretty well and would bump into. And so it was very exciting to get to see them again. I guess the trickiest part was that I couldn't hear the audience at all. Obviously, like, you play off the audience and you sort of riff with them. And because I was worried about that, I opted instead to do a couple jokes and then just read a humor piece I'd written before. Because that felt, you know, less audience dependent and more just a steady stream of jokes, if that makes sense.
So did you come up with coronavirus material or material unrelated to coronavirus for the parts where you were just offering a couple of jokes, not the story part?
We were all asked specifically not to do coronavirus jokes just because I think everybody feels so inundated with virus-related news and information right now.
Right.
So I did jokes about how I think I'm sort of half falling in love with the person I can see outside my window at all times, but how he's very devastatingly – he, like, shut his curtains a couple weeks ago, so now I really miss him.
Wait, were you looking at him when he shut his curtains, or he just happened to shut his curtains?
That would have been so devastating. No, I saw him periodically, and I couldn't tell if he could see me too, but I sort of kept waving and lurking by my window for a few days. And then one day I woke up and checked again, and then the curtains were just shut. And I imagine he either left town or, I don't know, just saw this strange woman waving at him and was, you know, suitably, rightfully, like, freaked out and then decided never to look outside.
Well, that's heartbreaking, Karen. I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Was it difficult to sort of push the reality of the coronavirus out of your mind to do this show last night, or did that feel like kind of a welcome relief?
Oh, man, that's such an interesting question. I feel like even when I'm trying to compartmentalize comedy from the virus, it's sort of impossible to do it 100%. There's always like a little bit of tension. Even physically, I can feel it in my body. But you know how when jokes are quite long, they have it, just the tension builds up until the punchline at the end. And so it felt, getting to do comedy with all these people that I really like, even though it was online, felt like that release of tension at the end, like at a punchline. So that was such a nice feeling to get to experience together as a group.
What do you think it means, though, right now for you and other comedians not to be able to get on the stage? What are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the most obvious one is that stand-up especially requires constant practice. Like, my friends and I are often pretty much every night normally, and so to not have that for weeks on end, I imagine I will be so much more brittle and uncomfortable when I try and do this again live. I think something that is nice is that, because maybe this is due to the city inherently, like what the vibe of New York is like, but I feel like we're always constantly having to jump from one thing to the next without really thinking or reflecting on what exactly we're doing. And you sort of feel like you have to keep being in motion. And this is all forcing us to stop and not only think of ourselves, but think of other people in our community and how to help other people and how to stay connected. And now it feels like we're being forced to be intentional about how we connect with each other. Even if that doesn't seem like it has direct results in joke writing, I'm sure that has direct results in how we operate as people. And I bet that will sort of shift the conscientiousness maybe, or just the sort of kindness in the culture of people doing stand-up and things like that.
You're still working, though. You write for Late Night with Seth Meyers, which is back on TV this week. What's it like working on the show from home?
Oh, it's a mix of good and bad, I suppose. I'm really glad to be able to work from home. Obviously, it's such a privilege to be able to keep working, but it's so nice to have some sort of structure to my day, because otherwise, you know, it just feels like one endless stretch of afternoon all day long. So I really appreciate that. But then it also, it's a bummer because I think especially for our show, all the writers are normally in the same room at work. So it's a very social environment. And a lot of our jokes are collaborative and often come from riffs that we do together. And it's a really sort of playful environment. And so it does feel almost like I'm on timeout and writing jokes. It feels like we've lost the summer camp vibe of work, which is such a big aspect of work that we love.
So what are you writing? What are some of the segments that you've been pitching now or that the show is working on?
So a lot of the things are sort of adaptations of our regular segments. And then I think a lot of people are now trying to figure out how to do comedy bits based on like Zoom and how to sort of make things land via Zoom. And I very gently pitched the idea of giving a tour of my bedroom because my bedroom is very boring and small. And I thought it'd be fun to try and make it seem like a huge deal that I was showing people my bedroom. But I don't think that's going to land. You're in a closet right now, right?
I am in a closet. Where are you? Are you in your bedroom?
Yeah, I'm in my bed. I will never leave my bed.
So you're doing all, did you do your show from your bed as well last night?
No, I made a huge leap. I went to my desk.
Wow.
Which is about 3 feet from my bed.
You don't like nod out at all while you're got the laptop open? That's what happens to me if I'm.
Oh, like, I mean, no, I absolutely do. I take like 10 naps a day.
Do you think comedians feel like they need to be constantly putting out new work right now just in order to remain visible and relevant? Do you think that's what's going on in some to some degree?
The idea of if I'm not working, I'm falling behind, I think is a very scary sort of like capitalist mindset that everybody is stuck in constantly. And I'm sure that affects comedians too, because our primary spaces of, you know, comedy clubs and like open mics have all been shut out. And so now it's like scrambling to try and figure out how to keep working. But I hope that is not really a true fear and that people are able to take time for themselves and adjust to this and take care of their mental health first before feeling like they need to scramble to put something out there.
Taking a break and thinking about the bigger picture and not just your work is critically important, but also hard when you're only in one space all the time.
And it's extra tricky because I feel like this amount of time and space that we've all gotten isn't because of a good thing. It's because of an objectively awful thing. And so it's really hard to be like grateful for this time. You know what I mean? Because it's due to something very sad happening.
Right.
And we should not forget about that and stay in touch with that and hopefully try and do good with that. But it's rough, especially if that's where like your income is from, then you still have to be making all these jokes, I suppose, somehow.
For sure. Where do people find you on social media?
I'm at Karen Chi on Twitter. It's my name with an extra E at the end. And then same handle on Instagram.
Maybe one day we'll see a picture of the love of your life who lives across the street if he ever opens
his blinds. Oh my God. If I meet him, you'll be the first to know.
Wonderful. Karen Chi is a comedian and writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers. Thanks so much, Karen. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
To listen back to all of our recent conversations with comedians during the coronavirus outbreak, visit thetakeaway.org/jokingfromadistance. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.